You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, September 26th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and you're listening to Radio Free Northwest.
We're watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon.
Comrades, this week we've rerun the November 15th, 2012 episode of Radio Free Northwest. It's true we're going in sequence, but I find this one especially interesting with all the recent political news. You didn't actually think electoral politics was going to get you out of anything, did you? This is actually one of my earlier appearances on Radio Free Northwest, where I delivered some of my election commentary. There are a couple interesting items in the comments from this episode, and I'll briefly read parts of them. The very first comment on this show reads, partly, "I truly believe that in the next couple of decades, large numbers of white Americans will migrate north, or rather flee north, to escape the coming slaughter that non-whites will unleash on them. That cannot be avoided. Self-preservation will eventually kick in. Those who do not flee will get a taste of black and brown brutality in more ways than one." Well, comrade, I certainly hope so. And I want to reiterate to everyone listening, you didn't actually think you were going to get out of precisely that sort of future, did you? Another comment early in the episode reads this: "As for migrating, I'm not convinced it's a good idea. For one thing, migrating is costly. When it comes to quitting one's job, abandoning one's house, and moving one's family up to the Pacific Northwest." Okay, as opposed to what? Just letting that black and brown brutality happen? Sorry, no. The Trump distraction has made people forget that we're in a civilization-ending crisis. What's more expensive? Selling your house and packing everything up to come here where you're supposed to be, as Harold comments about in this episode, or not and dying with everybody else? I just don't know. I can see why so many of you have a hard time with this choice. Okay, enough about that. Here's this week's rerun.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner of the Northwest Front, and I'm here to talk to you about the results of the 2012 election. Normally, I don't like to ad-lib, but this one is pretty much writing itself, so I won't need a script. Instead, I'm just going to sit here and talk at you until I get tired of it. So as I record this, it's about 9:50 p.m. Pacific time on election night, and quite frankly, we know what's happened. Barack Obama is just about to break 300 electoral college votes, and as I look up the stats from the 2008 election, I see he's probably going to be within 30, maybe 20 to 30 votes of where he was last time. So we can't say a whole lot has really changed. What do we do, flip a couple of small states? I mean, seriously, I figured Romney was going to lose, but I didn't see this ass-kicking coming at all. Now, we know all of this is largely due to the whole electoral college system and how big states end up swinging the vote. I'll let Harold cover that more, since I'm sure he's going to do a spiel on it again. What we ought to talk about right now is practical application. So here goes. If the last 4 years of Barack Hussein Obama didn't wake anybody up, and they clearly haven't, nothing is going to wake them up. What that really means is those of you who wasted a lot of time on system politics in the last year, year and a half, really need to stop it. You're actually making it harder on yourself in the long run, since you'll never recover that time that you should have been using to migrate. Oh, there's that fun word again, migrate. You need to migrate. Yes, you, the person hearing my voice. You, the guy behind the computer, or the gal behind the computer, or the person with the iPod listening to the podcast right now. Seriously, drop what you're doing and figure out how you're going to migrate. Several of you have heard my shtick before, but I'd like to think we're going to pick up a lot more listeners in the very near future, so I'll probably repeat it here again. All the way through college, I was becoming more and more radical right, as in hating democracy and getting sick of Republicans because they always sell us out. I was also becoming slightly more racially aware, but that didn't happen permanently until later. What's important to understand is we need to realize that the entire American political system is evil. And I don't just mean what it's become, I mean what it has always been. Democracy is evil. Our Constitution, as envisioned, had our country being 1/6 democratic. The House of Representatives was actually elected by popular vote. The Senate became democratic later, but that really doesn't matter because that happened as a result of having some democratic influence, that is, populist influence, in the government to begin with. A government which includes part democracy in its scheme of law creation or official election or anything of the sort is ultimately going to be pure evil. That democracy will spread and spread and spread until it takes things over. So one practical application of that information is that a third-party solution can't work even if we get rid of the two-party system because America itself is bad and wrong. Wasting time advocating for a libertarian or a constitutionalist or whatever else type of politics you want isn't going to get you anywhere. They can't help you because the system itself has to go. And believe it or not, the system itself will go. And soon, I think. There's a book that makes the rounds in the movement called March of the Titans, subtitled A History of the White Race. I think it's an excellent text and everyone ought to go pick up a copy and read it. The early part of the book ends up detailing all of white history that we can reliably get our hands on, and as it turns out, a lot of the civilizations we think of as brown used to be white. They browned out and then died off. What this means is we have no examples of a white civilization partly browning out and then coming back. When I was deciding whether or not I was going to migrate and support the Northwest Front, this is one fact I considered very, very carefully. America is in a state where we cannot recover America. Let me repeat that. All of America cannot be recovered. If you're wasting time on American system politics, you're hurting your own migration effort. Stop all that nonsense and migrate. The election's over. You don't need to work yourself up over some candidate that's not going to get elected anyway. Remember, the third party can't help you. As I record this, I see that Barry Ho has indeed topped 300 electoral college votes. No surprise there, all of the states we know he's going to get are big, important states that have big, important cities with big, important populations. This was a done deal to begin with, and we all knew it. Not only did we know what was going to happen this election, but because we've seen the last 4 years, we know what's going to happen for the next four, so let's consider what you need to do about that. The election's over, and you don't need to get yourself worked up, so migrate. Yeah, you need to migrate. I realize you can't just up and move. I didn't up and move, and I don't expect you to. I do expect you to save money, cut back on things you don't need, and get rid of possessions you don't use anyway. And for those of you that don't think that's a problem, and don't want to bother getting rid of anything and ready to move and make your effort to migrate, I would really like to hear from you what you think you're going to do differently. Because let's be honest, we all know what we're in for. I don't even want to get into it in detail. What is it that possesses people year after year to sit where they are? I've been in the Northwest for well over a year now, and it only took me a year to migrate. That year involved doing a little bit every day. By the time I was ready to migrate, events fell into place. I won't say they weren't somewhat coincidental, but to be honest, I would not have been in position to do anything about it had I not been working every single day. I gave up my leisure time to call jobs and put out applications. I gave up my weekend trying to figure out where I might live and what I might do when I got to the homeland. And that was all done long distance. Yeah, a lot of people may not be able to quite do it that way, but a job was my primary issue. The first thing you need to do is dedicate yourself to migrating and then figure out what your real problem in the migration process is and work on that. What you should do before you discuss the election with anyone else is decide how your migration's going to happen. I realize that's different for everyone, and I wish I could give you all specialized advice, but I can't. That's up to you. It's a task that's given to you to prove yourself worthy to begin saving your race. I'll be honest, it's not easy, we've never said it's easy, and it's going to get harder in the future, but it won't be better for you to stay where you are. and you all know it. The sort of people we need to bring about the Northwest American Republic are those who are willing and able to start this process, handle it on their own, and see it through to completion. I know you're out there, and I know you're listening to this right now. The real rot set in a long time ago, but history shows us the first truly visible marker of that rot is a mulatto leader. Yeah, BHO's not a mulatto, he's a nigger Jew, but whatever, you know what I mean. We've seen a confirmation in this election of that first visible sign. There isn't any reason for anyone to think they have a future anywhere but the Northwest. Part of what had me in such a permanently anti-American spirit was the realization that I, even coming from an upper middle class background with a good job and a great paycheck, had no future in this country because all white people are under the gun. I strongly suspect those of us who haven't migrated, even though we've known about the Northwest Front for years and years and years, somehow hold out this fantasy that there's a future waiting for you if you just don't rock the boat too much, and there's not. The longer you delay your migration, the worse you make your own future simply because you're not here with us. After Obamacare passed, I'd finally gotten sick of America. TARP, the original bailout, Obamacare, and everything else that's happened in the last few years illustrated to me that the will of the people doesn't really matter. Someone else has made these decisions. There's no reason to try and meddle in system politics when the outcome's already been dictated. I actually got to the point where I was trying to leave America for any place that would not abuse me so badly until I realized there was no such place and I was pretty much stuck with things how they were. I was in a pretty grim attitude until I found the Northwest Front. I evaluated the claims made in the Northwest novels and Harold's other material and decided it was my responsibility to make the NAR a reality. It's your responsibility too, and I hope you're finally willing to make that commitment. Hail victory, comrades.
Right, before we move on, a few quick comments on the latest election-related developments. Now, the media, almost in spite of themselves, have allowed a few items of genuine information to slip into their coverage, and so now it looks like I was correct in my assessment last week. There was massive vote fraud in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, which were the so-called swing states that put Obama over the required 270 electoral votes to be reelected. In about 50 precincts in Philadelphia, Mitt Romney received 0 votes. That's it, you heard me. 0. Zip. Nada. Goose egg. Now, we know why the Republican poll watchers were forcibly ejected from the polling places in Philadelphia by club-swinging nigger goons. A similar situation prevailed in at least 30 precincts in Cleveland. You steal Chicago, and you get Illinois. You steal Philadelphia, and you get Pennsylvania. You steal Cleveland, and you get Ohio and all their electoral votes. What did I tell you before the election, guys? Of course, by the next election in 2016, there will be at least 20 million more newly legalized Democrat votes from the Mexicans, so they won't need to bother with this kind of vote fraud anymore. By that time, white voters will be physically outnumbered in all the swing states and will be well on the way to a Democratic one-party state. Another interesting development since Election Day. Have you noticed how the liberal news media have managed to turn the Benghazi cock-up, where a U.S. ambassador and 3 imperial mercenaries were killed, into a sex scandal in order to divert attention from what really happened and Obama's role in it? Apparently, General David Petraeus, who was the head of the CIA last September, actually went to Libya himself and figured out exactly what happened, who knew what and when, and he was within a few days of testifying to that knowledge in front of a congressional investigating committee when all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, Sergeant Carter, it seems that the FBI has been monitoring the private email of senior military commanders and caught the general with his trousers down, buffing his biographer. And Petraeus has now been run out of the CIA and completely discredited along with any testimony he may have been about to give regarding Obama's role in the murder of the ambassador in Benghazi. How convenient. Looks like they're not through, either. This morning it was revealed that a team of FBI agents raided the Broadwell woman's home in Charlotte and spent 10 hours searching the place. For what? Stained dresses? Interestingly, it also seems that the FBI is gunning for the senior Marine commander in Afghanistan as well, who appears to have been sending naughty emails to some doctor's wife in Tampa. It looks like the Democrats may have decided to kill two birds with one stone. Silence and discredit a highly respected military officer who knows too much about what our man-child president did or didn't do as touching Benghazi, and also remove potential Republican dissidents high in the armed forces and ruin their chances to build political careers after they retire from government service, thus preventing any effective opposition from coalescing against the coming one-party state. By the way, for the record, no, I don't think Obongo conspired in any way to have Ambassador Chris Stevens murdered out of some deep, dark political agenda. Barry doesn't have agendas. He's too stupid. Now remember, we're talking about a high yellow dummy who can't even address a class full of third graders without a teleprompter, and who makes a fool of himself in front of the kids when the machine breaks down. I think on that September 11th, he just didn't give a damn. I think the truth that the Democrats are so desperate to conceal is that Obama was told what was going on in Libya. He was asked to come down to the White House Situation Room and deal with it, which would have amounted to approving a rescue mission from Imperial forces stationed in Italy, and he just couldn't be bothered. I seem to recall he was on some talk show that night, Letterman or Jay Leno. He was probably late, and he just says, "Don't bother me, I'm busy." Not that this was any great disaster, anyway. Yeah, four Americans were killed, but more than that are killed every week in Afghanistan and Yemen and wherever else Barry has troops strung out all over the globe. They're not Democratic appointees, though, so their deaths don't get any media attention. Also, can I ask whose brilliant idea it was to appoint a quote-unquote openly gay man to that post? In other words, what idiot in Hillary Clinton's State Department thought it would be a good idea to appoint a faggot as ambassador to an Islamic fundamentalist country? Probably Hillary herself. I've said to you people before, political correctness kills. En passant, I understand that Ambassador Stevens was sodomized before he was killed, and the same rebels did the same thing to their own president, Muammar Gaddafi, when they finally caught up to him in October last year. An example, I suppose, of the glorious diversity of our respective cultures. In America, the condemned man gets a last meal. In Libya, he gets a last buttfuck. Now that's gay liberation for you. Okay, this is an email from Mark in Illinois, one that was actually sent to me back in August, and which, like so many of the 200-odd emails I receive every day, kinda slipped through the cracks, for which I apologize. Dear HAC, look, I'm with you. The question I always ask is why white nationalism developed the way it did in the Northwest and why it didn't develop that way in the South. Still puzzles me. You're a Southerner. I have family in Southern Illinois. Southern Illinois supported the Confederacy. I never really heard that, but okay, fine. On paper, yeah, the South should be the place. But why have so many white nationalist heroes who had their stories take place in the Northwest? Where were the Southerners? What is it about the Northwest that brought out men like Bob Matthews, Pastor Butler, the Weavers, etc.? Signed, Mark. Okay, this is one of those questions about which entire books could be written and probably will be written someday, but because, to paraphrase Shakespeare, time and place do not serve, I'm going to have to try and answer this in 100 words or less. Southerners are certainly the most racially aware of all white American subcultures, that's true, but most of us also come with a lot of mental and political and spiritual baggage. Now, these items include a traditional paternalistic outlook on the race question, for example, rather than a clear national socialist conception of the racial nation. They include religion. There is a tendency to mix, "Oh, hate's a goddamn nigger," with the saving grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. Another heavy piece of baggage that Southerners pack around with them is the whole Ku Klux Klan thing, and don't get me started on that, except to say that the Klan, even at its best, was always completely reactionary, never revolutionary. Another item of such baggage is sectarianism. I will still be having good, steady email correspondences with Southerners who seem right as rain and really squared away and maybe ready to make the move to Northwest, and then they come up with some crack about damned Yankees. Now, entirely too many Southerners don't understand or don't want to understand that many of the objectionable traits they find in Northerners are in fact Jewish traits, and that our enemy is not the Northerner as such, never really was, but the Jew. A general failure to grasp the Jewish question at all and to confuse the Jews of today with the Israelites of the Bible is another problem that a lot of Southerners have. That hootin' holler shoutin' Baptist old-time religion isn't quite 700 Club, but it can still mess with people's heads. I could go on and on and on about that, but there's also the problem that the South is a huge area with a now predominantly non-white population if you include Texas and Florida, and it would be almost as impossible to detach that big of a landmass from the United States without a massive military capability, which we're not likely to acquire, as it would be to take the whole thing back, which, as I've already explained repeatedly, we can't do. We're going to have to do a lot with a little when the time comes. And unfortunately, the entire American South, as much as I'd love to see that Confederate flag flying in the air, it's just too big a bite for us to chew, and we have to admit that. I'm a Southerner, and I have to admit it. Now, the Northwest, on the other hand, besides its many attractions and advantages, which I've already enumerated on this show over and over and over again, is much more of a blank slate, or perhaps a clean sheet would be a better word. We need to try and look forward to the future and not backwards to the past. And the fact is that this territory here in the Pacific Northwest is the newest part of the country, the last to be settled. And really, the fact is that up until now, nothing much of earth-shaking importance has ever happened here, at least not compared to California or the South or the East Coast. Now, one of the Northwest's most understated but prime advantages for our purposes is precisely the fact that it is indeed such a relatively clean sheet on which we can write our own destiny. Okay, first music break. Now, some months ago, I played a piece by one of our English comrades of his own composition, and I'm glad to see that some of our musical people are at last learning what acoustic instruments are, and that white racial music is finally advancing beyond a bunch of clanging, slamming electric guitars in somebody's garage in Surbiton. Now, I'm not knocking all pro-white rock music, and certainly not Ian Stewart and the classics, so forth and so on. Now, some of it that I've played on here has been pretty good. But I'd like to see something like the folk music explosion of the 60s happen, but with a white racial tone. Anyway, this is a British racial folk rock group called Wolf's Head, and the song is called An England Scorned.
You sit there in your shirt and tie, boldly dictating a crooked smile while you fed us lies. You didn't trust your own persuading. You sought a slaying to keep at bay the few good men that warned. Well, the dawn is nigh, look to the sky, beware of an England scorned. Fall that I, the riddle I die, fall the riddle I. You were bought with coin and you played your part and you'll live to rue the day. You smite the ways of our hallowed land and ignore the plight of our people, while you grease the stranger's outstretched hand and shout that all are equal. There'll be bitter cries for your deeds and lies when Willard sounds the horn. And the Norns will glide through English sky and you'll reap an England scorned. Father, it'll lie. You were bought with coin and you played your part and you'll live to rue the day. Tell me, Father, Father, it'll lie, die. Hark to the sounded horn. When freedom cries, fill English skies, you'll wish you'd never been born. We'll be right back.
fight your part and you'll live to rue the day. To me, Father, all the riddle I die, hark to the sound it hold. When freedom cries, fill English skies, you'll wish you'd never been born.
The following is a letter that I received from the imprisoned dissident writer Bill White in Roanoke, Virginia. I won't go off into a long discourse on White's case except to say that he made one serious mistake. He believed that he could write or publish anything he chose on the Internet. In the old America, he could, of course. But this is the America of Barack Hussein Obama. Bill served 2.5 years before a federal judge reversed his conviction on grounds that he was protected by the First Amendment. The government appealed the reversal. White is like Edgar Steele in that he's one of these dissidents whom the regime pursues with an obsessive rage and hatred amounting almost to insanity, because he keeps defying them and he simply will not shut up when he's told. His conviction was reinstated by a higher federal court, and he is now looking at 10 more years in prison for the so-called crime of publishing on the Internet information which was already in the public domain and which could have been found within minutes by anyone who knows how to use a search engine. But when Bill White publishes the same information, it's a federal felony. I guess George Orwell had it right back in 1946 in his classic novel Animal Farm, when he wrote, "All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others." Or less equal, as in this case. This letter from Bill White is dated October the 27th, 2012. Hello, Harold. I was going to send you a brief case update so that you could share with your readers, but then this Chicago verdict was entered by surprise and suddenly much more is going on. Lest anyone be deceived by the allegations, prior to my arrest in 2008, I was an absolutely and strictly law-abiding citizen who never desired to cause anyone any real harm. I was angry, and I wanted to shake things up, but I believed in peaceful and democratic means of change. Now, the Seventh Circuit has decided that quote-unquote white supremacists are so inherently violent that the government does not need to prove any actual violence when accusing anyone they label a white supremacist of a crime. This is not law. This is political violence carried out under the veneer of law. Every white person should think about this. If you picket and protest and publish angry political material, you will be treated the same as if you had picked up a gun and murdered someone. About 300 years ago, an early criminologist noted that if you punish a thief the same as a murderer, you eliminate the incentive for the thief not to kill his victim to conceal his crime. Similarly, if you punish someone for speaking the same as for killing, you make political violence more reasonable than political speech. I do not share this view. I wish there was a way to stop the twin evils of democracy and Judaism in a non-violent, lawful manner. And so I continue speaking instead of hurting anyone. But Savitri Devi noted that democracy does not bring with it a reduction of violence, but a reduction in honesty about violence. And for these people to make my words violent while kidnapping and torturing me because I refuse to lie for them is nothing but base hypocrisy. I'm afraid to say more because to even suggest that a nation that governs the world with drone assassinations, mass starvation, and the brutal murder of political enemies might be properly resisted by force is probably a crime. The Jew cries out in pain as he strikes you, and America shouts nonviolence as it drags you to the executioner. What this decision means for me in practice probably isn't much. There are two more appeals pending in this case before anything actually happens. Now, if my attorney in Chicago follows my attorney in Roanoke, who was, persuaded not to file my appeal on time, I may be stuck, but I don't foresee that. The big question is whether the DOJ uses this to violate the judge's order, which was to remove me from solitary confinement, designate me a minimum security inmate, and place me in a camp. They may even try to ship me to Chicago, though there is not going to be any order to do so anytime soon. Beyond that, nothing much can be said. The charge, even if I am convicted, will likely carry time served concurrent with my served sentence. This Chicago thing puts a bit of a downer on the October 23rd hearing, which went very well. The judge sentenced me to 33 months time served, and my release date is still April the 7th, meaning that I will be released on April the 15th. The media, I'm told, spun things differently. However, the judge did order me placed in minimum security and ordered the servers seized in 2008 returned. Now, I'm told a lot of noise was made about some investigation in Orlando, Florida. I have only a vague idea of what happened. A state judge allegedly received a package containing a truly terrible threat. What that has to do with me, no one knows. But as my counsel pointed out, the government is not cutting me any breaks. If they had evidence to indict me, I would have been indicted prior to the September 12th hearing, not to mention the October 23rd hearing, as even an indictment would have greatly improved the government's case. What the regime is trying to do is to silence me by prosecuting me over and over again all over the country. They did it once, and I got out, and I wasn't silenced. And so they're looking to do it again, over and over again. Too many white people have been silenced in this way. Matt Hale most prominently, but I also think of the federal actions against Edgar Steele, Brian Calvert, Christine Greenwood, and even that war kid Alex Curtis in California. I've had Jewish shrinks tell me I'm narcissistic for thinking that the government is doing anything other than just the ho-hum normal and routine. But I would do anything to just be a normal ho-hum prisoner. The system is Jewish judges, and Judaized Gentiles constantly immersing others in their insane fantasy world. In the good news department, though, the ACLU has signed onto my case in the Eastern District of Virginia. Here the government paid an informant to make a threatening phone call to a so-called civil rights attorney who was suing me. The regime was going to charge me, but withdrew when they discovered that the FBI had authorized this informant to commit a crime. The civil rights lawyer sued me and lost. The case is now on de novo review on appeal. My case in Roanoke may also be reopened in a habeas corpus appeal, and while I have an attorney who is asking to represent me on this, if this appeal is granted, I'm hoping the ACLU will come in on this as well. In other good news, Matt Hale has written 3 books in prison, and I'm working on finding him a publisher. Hopefully, we can get something in print in 6 to 12 months. My counsel is also working with his counsel on a habeas corpus, providing my Chicago transcripts and discovery to support his claim of juror bias. I was going to tell you the story of my arrest, how I fought like hell not to be in the position I am today, as I thought your readers might like it, but this new development may make that unwise. Sorry for droning on so, but I hope all this is useful to your readers. Thank you for your support, Harold, and I wish you well. Sincerely, Bill White.
So, good evening, comrades. So, the day that I went to the library, I ended up finding a book on Jack London, I was actually looking for a book on Lovecraft. Now, Lovecraft is a very popular horror writer that I had heard of on Stormfront, and I've, I guess, heard of people that were fans, and I decided, why don't I find out a little about his life and what he was writing? I found Lovecraft to be a very eccentric character, really very different from Jack London, as it turns out. Jack London seems to have been an adventurer. Lovecraft, on the other hand, really could not be more the opposite. He seems to choose a very limited life. Lovecraft had a very traumatic adolescence. For some reason, at around the age of 18 until about the age of 23, so late adolescence, early adulthood, Lovecraft goes into a kind of self-imposed hibernation. He seems to just stay in his home. He doesn't want to see anyone. He stops going to school. And I'm really not sure how he functioned during these years. I'm not really sure how he was able to complete his education unless he was tutored at home. He was perhaps doing a little writing at this time, but nothing of note. So he becomes a writer after this, and he seems to have no interest in two preoccupations that many people care a great deal about. He seems to have no interest in romance, and he also seems to have no interest in money. He lives a life of seeming isolation, although in 1924 he does a very strange thing that really is so bizarre I almost dismissed him as a racial thinker, because he apparently marries a Jewish woman. And this was so bizarre, I almost wanted to give up on this individual and researching this individual, but the marriage lasts less than a year. He was from Providence. Lovecraft was from Providence. And he seems to have no interest in going anywhere, but because of his marriage, he has to move to New York. Now, it turns out that he hates New York, and really he can't stand being there. Now, at around this time, his wife loses her job. It's speculated that Lovecraft may have married simply for money, but if that's true, he and his wife fall on hard times. But his wife finds a new job in the upper Midwest. Now, Lovecraft could have gone with her, but he chooses not to. So the marriage takes place in March of 1924, and it ends in late December of 1924. So if they were in love, I don't know when they were in love. I mean, were they in love for 5 minutes? It's really very strange. Now, in this book, Lovecraft Against the World, Against Life, the author suggests that Lovecraft really could not say no to anyone. So he may have married this woman out of kindness, he may have married for security, or possibly for money. But perhaps just out of intimidation in a way, because she pursued him, and he was a very meek and mild-mannered and really very strange man who really could not deal with social interaction, it seems. He could not deal with any kind of changes in his environment, and he was very strange. And I think it's possible that he just agreed to marry her out of probably social pressure. Friends and family may have been encouraging him to marriage, and he just sort of gives in. But he separates from her after less than a year, and about 3 years later, she officially divorces him. He really spends his whole life in poverty, and he writes these very strange horror stories that take place in New England, and he tends to write about these very fanciful creatures that are very ancient and very dreadful, and he thinks that the world is about to be taken over by these horrible creatures. So he's kind of one of these doomsday soothsayers, or maybe a bit like a doomsday prepper, although he wasn't prepping per se. He was just contemplating this eventual doom. So I I don't really know what else to say about him, but that he's just remarkably odd and seems to have quite the following. Even in his day, he was considered very retro, so I suppose all the more now. I suppose there are a lot of references in his writing that people would find offensive these days or take exception to. So I just thought that I would do a little talk about his work, about his history, because there are so many fans. You know, I know that talking about these books, sometimes I wonder how relevant it is. Next time I'm going to have a book that's called Fighting for the Essence. So that's what I'll be talking about next time. So I hope you enjoyed this review and thank you for listening.
One of the most exciting musical innovations over the past 30 years or so, to my taste anyway, is the combination of traditional Scottish and Irish instruments, especially bagpipes and ullion pipes, with other forms of music and full orchestra. And I've played a number of these on here before, notably from the incredible combination of Sean Davey as composer and Liam O'Flynn as ullion piper. I've played cuts from the Granuala album, The Pilgrim, The Siege of Derry album, and so forth and so on. Now, this is a piece called The Wild Geese. I know that a lot of us have heard that expression in the past, especially referring to mercenaries. The term originated in the 18th century, when a lot of Irishmen had to flee to France and Spain because the British had made it illegal to be a Roman Catholic in Ireland, and most of the young men ended up serving in the Spanish and French armies because that was pretty much all they had to offer in the way of employment skills. And on more than one occasion, the Wild Geese regiments actually ended up fighting against the British on the various battlefields of Europe. This is Liam O'Flynn. Thank you. Right. Now we begin what I suppose you might call the deep philosophical part of the program. First off, on a personal note, I have had some of you tell me over the past couple of months that in my various writings and pronouncements, I am starting to come across as bitter and depressed, and I'm starting to sound like a grumpy old man. Now, that's probably because I am a grumpy old man. But yeah, I can see what these people mean. I see the window of opportunity approaching, and we're still playing around on the internet, and barring some kind of sudden and inexplicable moral and spiritual transformation, we are going to miss that window of opportunity, and our race is going to perish from the face of the earth. So yeah, I'm a bit grumpy. However, I know that I'm dealing with Americans, and Americans are very sensitive types, and so I will try to cheer up a bit.
Happy, happy, joy, joy, 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 happy, happy, joy, joy.
I got an email from an old contact of mine in Michigan, Bob Summers, and he writes as follows. Harold, you have to understand that the people you're ranting and raving at cannot respond in the way you want them to. They quite literally do not have it in them. They are Americans of the 21st century. The alpha gene that you refer to has been bred out or poisoned with Jewish indoctrination, and white Americans are now just running around like chickens with their heads cut off, begging and pleading for someone else to do something. They themselves just don't know how to go about creating an actual revolutionary political movement. They just don't know how to do it. They don't have the cultural or historical background like the Irish do. It's not in their blood. These are people who up until recently lived for trips to the mall and dinners out at Applebee's and Dancing with the Stars. They are angry and upset because they're losing all that, and I'm sure a number of them do in fact realize the implication of the recent election. White Americans know that they're a minority now, and most of them are probably terrified at some level, but they cannot formulate in their minds the very idea of actually resisting in an organized manner. At best, or at worst, some of them might decide to pick up a semi-auto rifle and go to the food court at the mall and start shooting down Mexican waiters and busboys and then blow their own brains out as the cops close in. But that's not revolution, that's idiocy. Harold, they don't know how to do it. You must tell them. You must hold their hands and walk them through it. Bob, what in God's name do you think I've been doing for the past decade? 10 years, 5 Northwest novels. How much more hand-holding and walking through are they going to need? Now you know why I'm turning into a grumpy old man. It is now 10 years after my own migration, and we should have been way farther along with this than we are by now. And it's not as if resistance would be impossible. Zion is not invincible. It took the Iraqis, what, 2 weeks to put together a resistance movement after the American invasion in 2003? A resistance movement that was eventually successful? Remember, the original intention was to make Iraq a kind of a colony and stay there for at least 30 to 50 years, kind of like a Middle Eastern Germany. Now, remember that huge U.S. embassy that they were building in Baghdad? That was meant to be the headquarters of the great American Middle Eastern oil empire that never was. Now, anybody who denies that the Iraqis ran the Americans' asses right out of there simply isn't living in the real world. But, yeah, I get what you're saying, Bob, and you're right. Okay, you guys want your hands held. Here we go, for the umpteenth time. Let's take it from the top. White people are now a minority in North America, at least electorally speaking. Within another decade or so, if present demographic trends continue, along with unlimited third world immigration, we will be a numerical minority as well. People with skins the color of shit hate us, because we are better than they are, and they know it. If they take over, they are going to kill us all, either through physical violence or through neglect and oppression. What part about they're going to kill us all is it that you don't understand? Now, you've got a choice. Now, you can continue to sit there behind your computer and listen to this show every week and continue to play on Stormfront and basically just sit there where you are year after year, go into your crappy little job every day, getting older and sicker, until one day you will become so elderly that you will be forcibly placed in some kind of government-run nursing home, either by the one-party Democratic state that's coming, or by your rotten liberal kids who want to get hold of whatever you might still have in the way of wealth for which I suppose you mustn't blame them, because life in the democratic America of the future is going to be very grim for anyone with a white skin. So I suppose you shouldn't try and blame your kids too much when they do send the men in the white coats to haul you out of whatever home you've got and take you to the fogey farm. They're just trying desperately to survive. You're old and you've had your day, you're done, and they're going to need whatever they can get for your house to try and keep themselves out from under the bridge for another year or two. Anyway, once you're in the government-run Obamacare fogey farm, your so-called caregivers will be black or brown shitskins, Nigerians or Filipinos or whatever. Now, these caregivers will hate you because you are white. They will torment you, rob you of anything that you have of value. They will beat you and starve you and abuse you. They will burn you with cigarettes, so forth and so on. And eventually, they will murder you, either through outright violence or through neglect. You will die in pain and torment in your 70s or 80s, most likely lying on a filthy mattress in your own excrement, where you will either freeze to death or else your shit-skinned caregiver will smother you with a pillow in order to steal your medication. I am not joking, and I am not exaggerating. Things like this are already happening to elderly white people in the cities who didn't get out in time when they were still middle-aged and still had some wealth and assets to get them out. Now, that scenario I just described, that really is probably how a good many people who are now listening to this podcast are going to die 30 or 40 years from now. And you know something? I think most of you know it. You must have at least some partial clue, or you wouldn't be listening to Radio Free Northwest. So why the hell won't you resist? Why will you not at least take the first step? Perfectly legal migration to the Pacific Northwest, where you can still live and make a life in a predominantly white world. I'm not going to deal now with the usual stupid excuses that most of you give, including that you're afraid of bears and you're afraid of volcanoes and tsunamis. Your excuses are stupid bullshit. You won't come here because of two things, cowardice and laziness. You are afraid that if you become involved with the Northwest Front, the bad men will come and try and hurt you. And yes, they might. It is entirely possible that they will knock on your door and flip their badges in your face and cause you to shit in your pants with terror, and that you will see their flashing LED lights from off the squad cars in your driveway reflected on your living room wall, and you will suddenly understand that it's no longer a computer game anymore, which will cause you to scream and run and hide in the closet, but they'll find you by the smell. Your fear is not illegitimate. Yes, the bad men may come. I'm not going to pretend to you otherwise. You can, of course, try to avoid this by not actually breaking the law, but that doesn't always work anymore. Ask Edgar Steele, or Bill White, or Matt Hale. So, what do you do? Surely, Harold can't possibly be serious about asking you to do things that might make the bad men come and hurt you. Well, yes, actually, I am. Quite serious. And when they come, let me tell you how to deal with them. You stiffen your spine, and you respond to them with an old character trait that our people used to have in abundance. It's called courage. You may have heard of it. You look them right in the eye. You tell them nothing that they want to know. And when they shout their questions and shove you against walls and take you places in handcuffs and threaten you and beat you and put you in freezing cells in midwinter with no heat and torture you like they tortured Bill White and Edgar Steele, you tell them to go fuck themselves. Only not in those words. You say to them five words only. I have nothing to say. Just remember that when you tell a police officer or a federal agent, I have nothing to say, you are, in fact, telling him to go fuck himself. And he knows it as well as you. Courage. Try it. It comes highly recommended. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
Harris, my old friend, good to see your face again. My welcome, though you're tramping that old man. For the wife is in a swoon,
and I am all alone. Harris, fetch your man, take us home. Oh, the wife and I came out for a quiet glass of stout and a word or two with neighbors in the room. But young Clary came in as wild and drunk as sin and swore the wife would leave the place with him. But the wife is quick as thought and said, no, I'll bloody not. And she struck the brute a blow about the head. And he raised his ugly paw and he lashed her on the jaw. And she fell upon the floor like she was dead. Harris, well, you know, I never struck an angry blow. Oh, would I keep a friend who raised his hand? I was a country in the war, crying, what the hell's this for? But I had to see his blood to be a man. I took him by the coat, spun him round and took his throat. And I beat his head upon the parlor door. He dragged out an awful knife and he roared, I'll have your life. And then he stuck me and I fell on the floor. Blood I was from neck to thigh and bloody murder in his eye as he shouted out, I'll finish you for sure. But as the knife came down, I lashed out from the ground, and the knife was in his breast. Carried her away. No hand was raised to help us through the door. Now I've brought her half a mile, but I had to rest a while. And none of them I'll call friend no more. For when the knife came down, I was helpless on the ground. No neighbor stayed his hand, I was alone. By God, I was a man, but now I cannot stand. Harris, fetch your man, take us home. Now Harris, fetch your man, and take us out of here. In my 9 of 50 years, I've never known that to call myself a man from a loved one I must stand. Harris, fetch your man, take us home. Thank you.
Okay, I'm running long here, which is what happens when I ad-lib instead of work off a script. I have to keep these shows below an hour and 20 minutes because I burn CDs of each episode and I send them to people who don't own computers. I guess that last part wasn't really deep and philosophical. It was more grumpy old man, but what are you gonna do? I was gonna give you guys another tirade on the second problem I mentioned, the one of white laziness, but we've all heard that before, so let's see if I can close with something a little less repetitive. Now, I've gotten a number of emails commenting on the 27 or so states that have allegedly started secession movements since Obongo's so-called re-election on November the 6th. Well, not really. Now, what these appear to be is online petitions on the White House website, which is some kind of gimmick that the Democrats started in order to pretend that they were listening to people. As I understand it, pretty much anyone can start one of these things, and judging from the wording, it looks like most, if not all, of these petitions were put up by the same person. Now, the gist of it is, oh please, Magic Negro, will you be so kind as to peacefully let Louisiana or Texas or Kansas go our own way? Yeah. Lots of luck with that. According to the rules of the website, if you get 25,000 signatures or more, your petition has to be quote-unquote considered by some Jew or nigger in the government. Now, so far, only Texas has the required 25,000 signatures. I'm sure that petition will give the O-Man's posse endless hours of amusement as they try to come up with the most contemptuous and vicious way to reject it. Why shouldn't they? They know we don't really mean it. They know perfectly well that white men are no longer willing to pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor for freedom. Are you crazy? If we were to do that, then the bad men might come and hurt us. Now, this isn't anything, people. It's internet, and internet isn't real. If it were possible to translate internet into real-world action, we'd have hundreds of families of white migrants settling in the Northwest every year. Now, the way it happened in 1860 was that the state governments of the South called secession conventions in most cases, or in some cases they passed an ordinance of secession through the state legislature. I will believe that there is a new secession movement when this kind of thing starts happening in the real world, but internet is just internet. You know, what really gets my goat is that if you look at the statistics, Americans are, in fact, the most violent and sociopathic nation in the world. We've got all these guns, and we slaughter each other by the tens of thousands every year, so it's not as if we're utterly incapable of direct action in the real world. But we never do it for any reason that matters. Now, I'm not just talking about nigger and Mexican gangbangers blowing each other away in drive-bys. Us white boys still drop quite a few bodies ourselves, you know. Thousands of white people every year take the guns out of the closet and the butcher knives out of the door for various reasons having to do with sex and ego and, above all, for money. Always for money. Or because our feelings were hurt. Or because the bitch made me crazy so I plugged her. That kind of nonsense. Never for any cause or reason that makes any sense at all. Never mind the cause of our own racial survival. We as a people are still capable of all kinds of direct and forceful action. We do it all the time, but never for anything larger than our own desires and our own egos and our own appetites. Now, there's a saying, war is when you let the government choose who the enemy is. Revolution is when you decide for yourself. Now, that's a decision you need to make and quickly because events are starting to move now. You don't need to shoot anybody. I'm not asking that. You don't need to break any of the tyrant's laws. No one's asking you to break the law. You need to come home so that when it all really does hit the fan, you'll be where you're supposed to be in order to be part of the solution.
Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington, 98310. You can visit the party at our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, comrades, hail victory.
Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fill the name of 98. Yet, thank God, it still is beating heart in manhood's morning new. Who could follow in their footsteps at the rising of the moon? At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon. We'll be right back.
Radio.com.